Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 16th December 2012. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Paul in London, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, Johnny Fox, Julie Raby, and Paul Chandler. We're now going to talk about Kiss Me Kate, which is the Chichester Festival Theatre production, which is now on the Old Vic. It's directed by Trevor Nunn and is, of course, music and lyrics by Cole Porter. It stars Hannah Waddingham as Lily Vanessi and Alex Bourne as Fred Graham. And also we have an appearance by Clive Rowe, which is a name that jumps out at me, although they're probably much more important people. The musical is, as people probably know, a version of... Well, it's a sort of a touring company doing Taming of the Shrew. So it's backstage. It's a backstage tale, really, although we do see, I believe, some of the play. Paul, could you tell me more about this play and what you thought of this production?
Well, actually, there was quite a lot to enjoy about this production. Actually, I forgot to mention Adam Garcia is in it. Is that his name? The guy that was in Coyote Ugly. He was in it.
Yeah, it was Adam Garcia.
Yeah, okay, I've got the name right. And he was great in it, actually. I thought he's getting better with age. But it's really a show within a show. But the show they're doing is a musical version of The Taming of the Shrew. For me, it was very traditional in some respects. It was very as though it was staged in 1948 when it was first produced. And I would have probably liked a bit of a faster pacing, particularly between the musical numbers, because things seemed to slow down quite a lot, and it was felt as if they were treating the book as though it was Shakespeare. But I didn't have Hannah Waddingham the night I saw it, but the understudy was quite good. Yes. And so I must say it was, it was an enjoyable evening, but it was a long evening as well. And I think if you weren't a particular fan of Cole Porter and weren't so keen to be hanging out for the numbers, of which, quite a lot are very familiar because they're standards in their own right, I think you'd find it a pretty long evening.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I went into this with quite optimistic because I'd heard good things. My sister had been to see it and been very excited about it, but then again, she has been rather a big fan of Adam Garcia's for the last 20 years, probably, so I think she was always going to enjoy it. I got more and more disappointed with it the more it went on, and it wasn't really the music. I didn't have a problem with the music. I generally have kind of accepted with musicals that the book isn't going to make a hell of a lot of sense and it's going to be a bit of an afterthought. But that only kind of takes me so far. And with this particular show, the book was just such a mess that I just got really frustrated by it. And I agree that there's too much of it. It just from what I've been told, this is a particular issue with this production, not just the play itself. Apparently, over the years, the book has been tinkered with a lot, and then this particular production, Trevor Nunn has added a lot more bits of actual Shakespeare into it. There's huge, great chunks of Taming of the Shrew in there. And for me, I just thought that the story, I just had no idea what it was trying to be. Was it a musical version of the Taming of the Shrew? Was it the backstage story? Every bit of it kind of just went on for so long that when it went from kind of front stage to backstage, you'd kind of forgotten what was going on in that scene. But by the sounds of it, that is largely Trevor Nunn's fault. I mean, I know it's a running joke that it'll make anything last for half an hour longer than it absolutely has to. And here he seems to have done it by just adding great big chunks of the Shrew. And I mean, if you're not going to, it's really a production within production, so it's not really properly the main focus. So it's not like you're getting any real laughs from the bits of Shrew that are in there. It's all very disjointed, and you get kind of couples and subplots that reappear kind of an hour after you last saw them. And I mean, I don't have anything against the cast. The cast were really good. I mean, one of the names that jumps out is Clive Rowe. I think him and David Burt are there as a couple of kind of comedy gangsters in the background, which it right up until the end when they get Brush Up Your Shakespeare, which is kind of the biggest fun number and is really the highlight of the show. Until then, you're kind of wondering what on earth people of that kind of caliber are doing in those kind of background roles, especially Clive Rowe, who has very little to to say up until then, and is just kind of hulking in the background and doing kind of physical humour, which works. But I think that another issue I had with it was that the humour was just far too infrequent. And I mean, it's really not the sort of thing you should be taking particularly seriously. It should be really, you know, clearly it's a story that should be a silly, fun show. And I wasn't getting that. I was quite bored by it, to be honest. And this was my first time I've seen Kiss Me Kate, so it's hard to... I'm having to take people's word for it that there are a lot of adaptations from the original that are causing some of the problems I had with it. But certainly what I saw of it made me wonder why this was a great... apart from a couple of songs, which are really standouts. But apart from that, as a show, it made me wonder why it was considered such a great classic.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, Nick, because I actually also felt that it was really like... It felt like Kiss Me, Long Pause, Kate. Because there was so much dialogue it felt at times. And I've seen Kiss Me, Kate before, and while it was quite a long time ago, I didn't remember the dialogue to drag so much in the show. But having said that, you know, there was quite a few great musical numbers. I think the highlight definitely was Brush Up Your Shakespeare, that you mentioned. But also when Adam Garcia does Bianca, which turns into this great big song and dance production number, which is Cole Porter music isn't the easiest to sing at the best of times. And then to add dancing onto it, I thought it was, and you know, you could just see in the performers' faces just the sweat, the near exhaustion it looked like they were getting to in doing the number. It was quite a lot to admire, I thought, in some of those big numbers.
Yeah, this is the thing. I think musically that there are some great numbers in there, but the way they're strung together is just so. There seems so little care in how it's strung together. You know, it's just and they're too far apart, the numbers. There's just too much in between them, and there's too many stories going on. The story's not complicated, but there's dozens of them going on, and none of them really get properly resolved. It kind of, by the end, it's kind of and then this person came back. And that's it. Look, let's not worry about all this. We've just opened up 30 different storylines, and none of them make sense. So we'll just have a big ending.
Yes. Yeah, and at some point too, in the last 10 years, I think they've added an extra song which was not in the original Kiss Me, Kate. From this moment on, which the leading lady sings with her potential future husband, and it was kind of like, oh, when did this get? When did this come into the show, and why is there another song here that just is to distract from and adds more complexity to the plot? Yes, it could do with a simplification, I think.
We're now going to talk about Privates on Parade, which is the first play in the company's season at the Noel Coward Theatre. This is Peter Nichols' play with music by Dennis King about a song and dance unit in Southeast Asia, which is called Sadducee. And we have, it's essentially a concert party in Singapore and Malaysia during what's known as the Malaysian Emergency, where Chinese, mostly Chinese communist rebels, I think it was, were fighting against sort of the British Empire and trying to free themselves from the shackles of the British Empire, I suppose you could say. The star of this production, they say, is Simon Russell Beale as Captain Terry Dennis. I mean, it's a very famous role, this, most famously done by Dennis Quigley and Roger Allam in productions some years ago, and also I think Dennis Quigley played him in the film of the movie. I've only ever seen the movie before, and I have to say this was a lot better than the movie. I think they sort of extracted all the fun out of the when they did the movie. There's an awful lot of fun in here, as well as all the serious side, but it seems that whenever we make movies in this country, we suck out all the comedy of everything and just show the misery. history. Nick, could you tell me more about this production?
What was this about? I hadn't seen this before. I'd heard certain things about it. It's strange because I was possibly a bit distracted by the prospect of Sam Swainsby running across the stage naked, but I did generally enjoy this. With some reservations, I think I thought the darker side in the second act didn't entirely work for me. But yes, this is essentially the story of the character who's representing the author is called Stephen Flowers, and he's played by Joseph Timms, who's people who go to the Globe a lot probably recognise him. And he kind of arrives there on sort of national service and discovers this much more informal military world there. There's a couple of more old school officers in charge, but they largely are off to one side, kind of grumbling about the entertainment corps every so often, and they're kind of where a lot of the darker side of the play comes in. But certainly on the surface of it, there is like you say, there's a lot of fun, which is the overall impression you get from it, because it's people whose main job is to entertain the troops, so you get a lot of their numbers. And Simon Russell Beale is playing, largely appearing in drag, and generally appearing in drag as specific people. So he's kind of appearing as
Carmen Miranda, Vera Lynn.
Carmen Miranda, Vera Lynn.
Noel Coward.
Yes, there is Noel Coward as well. Yes, which is quite appropriate given where it is. And there's Marlena Dietrich as well. Yeah, so I found I really like Simon Russell Beale in this. I think especially after back in the summer, I thought he maybe didn't phone in Timon, but I thought it was a bit SRP by the numbers. Whereas this, I thought this for me was kind of a big fun camp part that he added a lot of kind of nuance to and a lot of kind of emotion under the campness and the silliness. So I thought he was excellent in it, and I think we've got an alternative view on that.
I wouldn't say an alternative view. I think I have a perspective on it because I saw the 1977 original with Dennis Quilley and Nigel Hawthorne, and I have loved Privates on Parade. I thought it was a wonderful piece when I first saw it, and so I was very excited to see the Grandage version because I had missed his 2002 production at the Donmar with Roger Allam playing Captain Terry Dennis, which I thought would be excellent, but it was the year I lived in New York, so I couldn't go. And I liked a lot of things about this that gave the show good production values. I love the crumbling Singaporean villa set, and Paul Constable's very subtle lighting. Some of the changes of mood are really well underscored by what she's done. But I thought that in the impersonations by Simon Russell Beale of particularly the drag acts that he does of Marlena Dietrich and Vera Lynn and Carmen Miranda, he's very reliant on the costume and the Richard Morby wigs, which would be way beyond any kind of army budget and therefore are a bit distracting. And I felt it was rather like being mugged by a box set of the two Ronnie's Christmas finales, because they just came thick and fast, and they really were very like Ronnie Barker's drag acts in those shows. Where I do think Simon Russell Beale has done very well is in the subtler elements of the part, which Nick touched on, because Captain Dennis is apart from being an outrageous old queen, is also something of he's everybody's auntie, but he really does have a tender heart. And without giving too much of the plot away, there's an act of self-denial and heroism, really, for which he's responsible, that shows he is a much more layered and multidimensional man than the surface campery would suggest. However, there were moments when he was doing the sort of camp act, and more visibly acting than I think the person adopting that part should do. But I really wanted him just to get off the bloody stage and let me have a go at it, because I think I've done it as well. When he's not on stage, I really do feel that the action flags. It's as though Grandage spunked all the money on Simon Russell Beale and his apparatus and undercast the rest of the show. You mentioned Sam Swainsbury and somebody else, but I didn't know any of the younger actors playing the soldier parts. I didn't think any of them was outstanding, certainly not compared with the 77 cast or with James McAvoy, who I believe was very good as Stephen Flowers opposite Roger Allen. And something else I didn't quite like, the play is meant to highlight casual racism, so all the British officers discuss tactics and their attitude to the chinks and the wogs and the Anglos and the very rude words about women and about black and Asian people in front of two mute Asian servants who are the bearers who look after the theatre troupe. And they don't speak throughout, although they exchange meaningful glances occasionally. And at the end, Grandage stages what looks like their sort of coup and their revenge for everything that they've been denied by revealing the skyline of Singapore and them looking kind of smugly at it. But that's really nonsense. And it's a piece of bad historical research, really, because although the Chinese communists did inherit the territory of Singapore and much of Malaysia, they lost it again in 1963 to a new regime when Singapore detached itself from Malaysia, and that whole sort of brilliant skyline was built by the stricter right-wing regime of Lee Kuan Yew and his administration. So I found that a bit silly, really. The other thing I found a bit silly was, not silly, but unconvincing, was the foregrounding of the romance between the married regular soldier and a gay homebody type among the national servicemen who sort of... It's like a romance, the kind of romance you get in prison where a tough prison occupant will befriend a more sort of queeny prisoner who then looks after him and makes his cell comfortable and all that kind of thing. This seemed to me to be more foregrounded than I'd remembered from the 1977 production, and I felt it unbalanced the piece a bit, as though Grandage thought that was all the play was about. Did you pick up on that, Nick?
Well, I couldn't have said, for me, it came across as, I was just going to say, it came across one of the major parts of it, but then, like I say, you've got other performances, other productions to compare it to. I thought that was really quite well done, and I think it. I mean, for me, the point of that, which was the relationship between them, that were played by John Marcus and Harry Heppel. I thought that was for me, it provided kind of an emotional contrast to the straight relationship that we had in there, which was really quite uncomfortable. I think the only reason I found it odd is that there's. You always hear so much about how Stephen Flowers is Peter Nichols's alter ego. So the fact that he actually turns quite so unpleasant as the play goes on, I didn't really know how to take that, whether that was meant to be Nichols kind of criticising himself or whether he was kind of not realising quite how nasty Stephen was coming across as. But I think with his relationship with the... half Welsh, half Indian girl, who's the only woman on there, who's played by Sophia Hack, who I thought was very good as well. I thought the point being made was that the kind of the gay relationship was the one with heart in it, and whereas the straight relationship was the one that's being shown as kind of looking like the kind of big romance at the centre, but actually being quite hollow underneath. But like I say, I mean, that's kind of how I took it, but I didn't have another production of it to compare it to. But it did certainly come across as very major to the story, so it's interesting that you feel like it wasn't always part of it to that extent in the past.
I think you're right that the relationship between Stephen Flowers and Sylvia Morgan, the half-caste Anglo-Indian girl, is less tender and less genuine than the romance between the two soldiers. But I'm surprised you say you thought Stephen Flowers behaved unkindly or aggressively. He's set up. She is completely manipulative because she's got pregnant by a man who died and tricks him into thinking that the baby she's carrying is his. So I think his reaction when he finds this out and doesn't want to bring her back to England is fairly fairly realistic for a soldier in those circumstances, in those times. Whether that is based on Peter Nicholls' own experience, I don't know. I just sent for a copy of his out-of-print autobiography from which this book is based. It's called Feeling You're Behind. So I'm quite looking forward to reading it over Christmas and getting the whole story.
Perhaps, I mean, yes, you're probably right in that. Perhaps it is a question of emphasis in the production, in that because maybe the other... I think because maybe the other relationship was contrasted so much, it does make him look worse in comparison. Where kind of if you look at it from a different perspective, I think it's also the fact that I think the reason he kind of I found him coming across quite badly is that this it all kind of goes in with the storyline where he's being promoted and kind of starts becoming more distant and. As a result of the promotion, you know, it's so it feels like he's kind of this sellout character. So again, it may be something I need to revisit at some point, because I think I was possibly distracted by certain things and you know, need to kind of see it from a maybe I need to go into it knowing a bit more about it than, because I like to go into things, you know, with kind of as clean a slate as possible. But maybe kind of, yeah, I think it's certainly selling it as something worthy of discussion. So, and I should point out actually that, because I think, I mean, obviously this over the season, I think this varies hugely whether the £10 tickets are actually available anymore. From what I've heard, the £10 ones for the Peter and Alice have completely sold out already. But so it probably varies depending. But the Noel Coward is among the better West End theatres for getting a decent view from the gods.
And you?
So I was in front row of the balcony, which I largely took because I would rather look kind of through a barrier than have to bob around the head of the person in front of me looking through a barrier. Actually, I was looking at the rake in the balcony is fantastic. So you, even if you're kind of further back in the balcony, from the front row of the balcony, I felt like I could really see Simon Rossabill's facial expressions very clearly. So you're not getting the best seats in the house for a tenner, but you're not getting kind of stuck behind a pillar.
No. I mean, he was wearing more slap than Dusty Springfield, so you would have been able to see his facial expressions probably from across the street.
We're now going to talk about Boy Meets Boy at the German Street Theatre. This is a musical comedy with book by William Solly and Donald Ward, and music and lyrics by Bill Solly. John, could you tell me about this and what it's all about?
I can, really, because it's a show I've waited to see for something like 30 years, I think. In the mid-1980s, I picked the cheaply produced black-and-white printed original cast album of Boy Meets Boy out of a bargain bin in Tower Records in New York, and it instantly became the favourite show I'd never seen produced. It is written in, I think, about 77, something like that, by a couple, as you say, Bill Solly and Alan Ward, and neither the composer-lyricist, nor the book writer, nor any of the actors in it went on to do anything else. So although it ran nearly 2 years off Broadway at a tiny 70-seat theatre, it has to be said, it ended the career of practically everybody associated with it. That doesn't stop it having been frequently revived. It's been in a lot of summer stock productions in the playhouses on Cape Cod and in Connecticut. Every university drama department and sort of... amateur club in America must have done it at some time. In the annals of gay theatre, you could set it alongside something like Terence McNally's farce, The Ritz, you know, that thing that was famously filmed with Rita Moreno, set in a gay bathhouse. But apart from, as I said, apart from amateur productions in the States, this debut at German Street is your first opportunity to see it. What it's about is it's set in 1937 during the abdication crisis and the romance of King Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson, the American divorcee over whom he resigned the throne. And there's a basic premise in it that, and I think it's something to do with the parody of morganatic royal marriages, is that men are able to marry either women, as in the case of Edward and Mrs. Simpson, or men if they feel like it, as in the case of the two central characters in the story. But there's no politics about it. There's no polemic at all. Nobody ever says whether or not this is a good idea. It's just taken as completely matter of fact that in the 30s, men married men as easily as men married women. And what happens in the plot is that an American foreign correspondent, a man called Casey O'Brien, that's right, is sent to London to follow the royal marriage and sleeps through the abdication crisis. And in pursuit of another story, he follows an English socialite, a man named Guy Rose, who has jilted his male bride at the altar. And so Casey O'Brien, the journalist, follows this story instead, falls in love with Guy, the English Rose, and 2 hours later, via a succession of bars and restaurants, the Dorchester Victoria Station, a Parisian cabaret, a can-can house in Pigalle, well, the charismatic and penniless triumph over the rich and charmless, and love conquers all. It's really quite sweet. And the music's lovely as well. It's all pastiche of The Boyfriend or the 20s musicals that have already been much spoofed. I mean, it's pretty like No, No, Nanette in the story of somebody running away for love kind of thing. And I think it's extremely well done. There's a really clever set. There are two ways to play this. You can either do it with your tongue firmly in cheek and send the whole damn thing up, or you can try and do it with as much conviction as possible. And I think that's the route they've chosen at Jermyn Street. And I really think they do it with panache. I much enjoyed it. How about you, Nick?
I came to this very much from the opposite end. I had not only not heard of it, but I wasn't going to book it. I think this was entirely on the recommendation of another theatre blogger who said you have to go see this. I don't think the publicity for the show has particularly done it any favours, because it made it look incredibly twee, and I just thought, okay, I can ditch that. But I was kind of told, no, you absolutely have to go and see this, and I did. I really liked it. I liked it because it's just so bonkers, and it's kind of subversive in a really lovely way. And as you say, it's not politicized, but it says as much, if not more, as something much more overtly political on the subject would, in the way that it just kind of has this utterly kind of 1930s musical storyline of the American coming over to London. It's a Top Hat, isn't it? Is the one I'm thinking about that was recent that had that storyline. At least this one doesn't have. At least this one's journalists, so you don't have somebody turning up for a show having never rehearsed for it, and then going on holiday to Europe. Although they do go on holiday to Europe straight after London as well, because it's a pastiche of that kind of musical. But as you say, it's just completely without any kind of commentary on the fact is that it's a gay couple. And yes, I agree. I think it's the way it's played completely, not earnestly, but just it's played straight, if you pardon the pun, is what makes it work, because it has a heart to it, but it is also completely bonkers at times. I mean, I was kind of in hysterics when they just the central couple bond over their jolly hockey sticks memories of being in the Boy Scouts and how wonderful it was, and they have this big song about it, and it was just brilliantly insane. So yes, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it a lot more than I would have thought from kind of looking at the description in the publicity. So I think it's definitely, I mean, it's probably too late now for anybody to catch it. It closes very soon, but it's a really entertaining show. Very, very fun. Just really sweet in the right way.
I hope it does have a life after Jermyn Street. It looks as if it might, because the set, if nothing else, is extremely solid and 17 different scenes. It does very inventively. So you never know, if somewhere's dark and quiet in the new year, it might get a little transfer.
We're now going to talk about In the Republic of Happiness, which is a new play at the Royal Court by Martin Crimp and directed by Dominic Cook, and a rather interesting set by Miriam Bierta. The cast is rather good, so rather starry. We've got Anna Caudle Marshall, Emma Fielding, Michelle Terry, Paul Reedy, Stuart Macquarie, Peter White, Ellie Kendrick, a good name if you're collecting people for your Game of Thrones people on stage list, and Celine Hisley. We start really with a family gathering. They're gathering for Christmas dinner. It is interrupted by a character called Uncle Bob, who comes in and basically tells him that his wife's outside. His wife Madeline is outside, and that she hates them all. Essentially, and we see the tensions within the family, which are sort of slightly exposed before Bob's entrance, and then he sort of slips in and destroys everything, or tries to destroy everything, although they do fight back. Then Michelle Terry, playing Madeline, comes in and really puts the death knell in, and it becomes more and more strange, especially when she goes off, emerges from a bathroom dressed in a rather elegant cocktail dress. The scene then rather suddenly changes while she's singing a song into, well, just a what looks like a daytime discussion panel, really. And we get a lot of satirization of daytime discussions and the sort of adverts you get if you watch too much cable television or satellite television, these sort of self-actualization stories, people saying, I'm a good person, and saying what they think they're entitled to. This section of the play is called The Five Essential Freedoms of the Individual, and it is five topics, and they talk around the topics. Now, this is rather cleverly done in the play, in the text. We see no actual names assigned to anybody. They're just any old people. It's suggested in one or two of the interviews I've read about it that they actually have come up beforehand, or they come up on the night with who's actually going to say it. They all know every single line. They've all learned all the lines, so they just decide either on the night, or I'm not entirely sure whether it's on the night or they've decided beforehand who speaks when. So they're watching each other to see what they're going to say. And it's really rather cleverly done, this, I think. And it's you have this idea that Martin Crimp often does, of this slightly reminiscent of what you might call a collation tale or a collation song. I mean, we think of things like Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham, you know, where you list all the things that he doesn't like. He won't have green eggs with all the various things he won't have them with, or something like the 12 Days of Christmas, a song where you sort of keep listing everything you've listed beforehand. And I really appreciated a lot of this, and I appreciated a lot of the satire of it, but there is one major problem. After about 20 minutes of this, I'd had enough, and there was another 30 minutes of this to go. It was interminable. It felt appalling. This 50 minutes of this kind of discussion panel, although it's punctuated with people singing songs and they change the subjects, it's just tedious, really, and it's half the play. You're there for 2 hours, and you've got something rather interesting, this family breakdown idea, and then you get this thing which... It's interesting to start off with, but you just don't know why they keep doing it, because it's boring, quite honestly, and it's so disappointing. I am a massive fan of Martin Crimp, and this is very disappointing. It was very disappointing that I felt so bored, and we were getting walkouts, people just walking out of it. Now, I've heard Martin Crimp on other programs saying that he slightly congratulates himself because he thinks that people are walking out because they can't handle things. There are times when people put the lights up and the actors are directly sort of challenging the audience, trying to make them respond, although they don't, you know, it's done so that they don't actually get a word in, they aren't actually able to get a word in, and it makes you feel uncomfortable. You know, Emma Fielding or Michelle Terry staring at me, I felt uncomfortable. And yeah, that's if he's trying to do that, that certainly worked, but all the charm had gone out of it after 20 minutes. As I said, it's just tedious, and it's such a pity, because I just felt that this could have been maybe it needed to be handled better. Maybe they needed a director who was more able to stand up to Martin Crimp and say, come on, we can't have this, all of this, we can't, you know, we've got to sort of pep it up in some way. Or you have a mad director who could have just pepped it up and done it completely weirdly. Now, I've seen a previous production of Martin Crimp's Attempts on Her Life, which had similar ideas like this and actually had this sort of panel bit halfway through the play. That in that case, it was satirising arts programmes and the way that arts programmes perform. So the first time I saw it, it was in the mid-90s. It was satirising a Radio 4 programme called Kaleidoscope, which was their afternoon arts programme. And it sounded exactly like that. And then when Katie Mitchell did it at the National Theatre, she did it as more like a BBC Two late review programme, where you had somebody who was doing a very good impression of Tom Paulin, who was very big at the time, doing those same sort of lines and those same sort of ideas. But that actually was a very brief part of the Attempts on Her Life, which it worked particularly well. And I think he's sort of expanded it over much here, and is sort of, you know, thinking that people, if they're walking out, they're walking out because they're feeling uncomfortable. And I would say no, they're walking out because they're feeling bored. And it's such a pity, because you then, after this 50 minutes, you get a rather interesting scene, rather an effective little scene with just Uncle Bob and Madeline together, and it's okay, but you've lost... I'd lost all hope and lost all faith in this play after that, after seeing, you know, this middle bit, and I think it's really let down. And for people who aren't familiar with Martin Crimp and don't, and aren't like me and think he's a genius, because I do, even now, it must be extremely disappointing for people. So, Julie, what did you think of this?
It's difficult to say, really. I felt that it wasn't as bad as I'd been reading the tweets on Twitter and some of the comments that were circulating during the week. But I thought, like you did, that actually the problem was that it just went on and on. Firstly, I didn't quite get what was happening, what it was supposed to be about, what the point of the whole thing was. So like you said, that 50 minutes in the middle, you thought, oh, it's quite entertaining, but I'm not quite sure what you're doing with this, where it's going, where it's taking me. It's too obvious. You know, it's making comments on life and things like that. I get that, but I don't understand why you're doing it. The set was interesting as well, the changes in the set. So you go from that domestic room, as you say, to the TV show, and the set's kind of moving up in the air and changing in front of you. But that, for me, wasn't enough, really. It needed more than that. I think I quite got the flat ironic humour, and I thought, oh, that's, you know, that's quite good. But again, it went on and on and on. And I was quite interested in how they did do that middle part and split the lines, as you said. But again, because it was so repetitive, it didn't work. It didn't work for me. I thought Michelle Terry was great. I think, you know, she's always very good. And I thought she was very good in this. But it was 1 hour, 45 minutes when I saw it. So they've obviously cut a little bit out of it. I just needed a bit more to kind of put it together. And for me, the last scene was just, it just didn't work at all, the last scene. I could have just kind of leave it at the end of the second act, because the last scene didn't help at all. Maybe I'm missing something. But it felt either too obvious in your face and nothing that actually pulled it together as a whole piece.
It's a shame about that last scene, because I think if you hadn't had to go through the scene before, it would have worked a lot better, I think. And it just felt like a slight adjunct, which was unnecessarily an appendix almost. Paul, what did you think about it?
Well, let me tell you the story of me and this play, if you like. I have seen one Martin Crimp production before. That was the Playhouse, definitely the Bahamas at the Orange Tree. I didn't massively like it, but it was interesting, and I was certainly glad I saw it. I booked for this show on the day. I'd done something I don't normally do and wandered into the What's on Stage forum thread, and the first post there described it as starting off okay and then becoming a car crash. So I had that in my head going in, I must admit it. So we went in, took our seats, the play starts, and the Uncle Bob character comes in, like you say, and he's slagging off the entire family, and I'm thinking to myself, well, I probably wouldn't let someone come into my house and say those things to me, but, you know, okay, I'll go with it. And then the Michelle Terry character comes in and asks to use the toilet, and I'm thinking, well, I'd probably say, no, you can't use the toilet. Get out, prepare it. But okay, she uses the toilet. And then there was my favourite moment of the whole show, where Michelle Terry starts to sing and produces a microphone seemingly out of nowhere. And I can't believe we haven't mentioned the set changes yet, guys. The set changes caused quite a lot of excitement on Twitter and social media.
They are certainly very good.
There's, a rather wonderful set change where everything peels back. I've still got that song in my head now, annoyingly. I thought it was very catchy. And you're thinking, well, this show could go anywhere. You know, what's going to happen? And then we go into that interminable, never-ending second act. People, as you say, the night I saw it, people were walking out as well. I was trapped in an aisle. I was jealous of the people leaving. It was, I just had such a strong negative reaction to it. I hated it absolutely. I at one point I took my glasses off so I couldn't see. I think that was the sort of the fourth or fifth one. And you know, all that talk about vaginas and Hitler and opening legs and I write the script, and it was just terrible. And then we go into that third act, and you know, I didn't care at that point. I just wanted it to end. I did something I never do and checked my phone to see what the time was, and it seemed to be over how long they said it was going to be, but it had started late, like everything does at the Royal Court seemingly. So, but finally it ended. So we left. I immediately tweeted something about it being, it felt like the worst show I'd ever seen at that point. And, you know, several of us had really had a reaction against it, and also would have left if we could have done. My friend Ian liked it, and I just couldn't get with his position at all. And I thought about it more as the days went on, and I read more people's opinions and talked about it with people a bit more. And I started to think, you know, is it me? Have I missed something? Are there wise comments on modern society that have gone over my head? Is it just not to my taste? And pretty much 6 days later now, that's where I am. I don't know whether I missed something. I don't know whether it's just not to my taste. I don't know whether they're just banalities they're uttering. I don't know if Crimp's some sort of genius that I don't understand. It's probably confused me more than any show of the year, I would say. And one of the things I said when I came out of the theatre was, if you have a ticket, burn it so no one else can use it. And I found another review that said something along those lines. But what I would probably say to you now would be, go to this show, see for yourself, see what reaction you take, and maybe try and get an aisle seat. So if you do want to leave, you can do. I think that's just about where I am.
Yeah, I mean, I do kind of agree with you. I think that the problem, as I said, is that he has a lot of good ideas, but after 20 minutes, they're exhausted of the middle section. That middle section, if it was only sort of 10 or 20 minutes long, or 10 or 15 minutes long, rather, it would have worked quite well. But it's just too long and too... It's not that it's uncomfortable, it's just too repetitive, too, you know, too tricksy. And I think a lot of people have liked it because they like the ideas and they think, oh, well, people, you know, people won't understand these things and they'll be amazed by it. Well, no, this tends to be something that I see quite a lot in sort of certainly foreign directors do and European directors do. They think we're slow to catch on, and we're not slow to catch on in the audience. We tend to be rather quick to catch on, and you know, you catch on very quickly to what he's trying to do, and it's okay for a while, and then it stops being okay because he keeps going on and on and on, and you think, yes, you've delighted me long enough, please stop. And he's not stopping, and it's not because he's, you know, good. It's because he's just feels like going on. It's a disappointment, because he is a good playwright and he is very well worth getting to know about. I mean, he's a very skilled translator. A lot of his work, I mean, things like he's very famously did The Misanthrope, and quite recently with Keira Knightley in it. That was a year or so ago, and he's very good at that sort of thing. And he is a good playwright. He's very well worth getting to know. But this is a disappointment. And I, you know, anyone who thinks it's wonderful, frankly, yeah, they're a bit of an idiot. It's not. Has the potential to be very good, but it's not good in this production, and it would need a lot of work to make it good, unfortunately, I think.
Were people laughing when you were there? Because quite a few people were actually laughing. I think
you meant to laugh in some places. Laughter,
No. The kind of, this deadpan kind of dry, ironic humour that's going on. And the bloke next to me loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah, there was certainly laughter. I mean, a mix of of laughter and in there. So when I saw it, I mean, people were very happy. You know, were quite happy to see it. But I think on balance, most of the audience when I came out were, you know, pretty annoyed with it. Just thought things had gone on too long, I think.
It wouldn't have worked with an interval, though, would it? I mean, you kind of have this... You kind of think, oh, if they put an interval, then nobody would come back, that kind of thing. So they have to keep people in. But I don't think it would have worked with an interval.
But say... Yeah, you're right. Say there was an interval between the first and second acts, because that's obviously where it would be, and they'd have to do it in a different way with the song starting and the scene changes and whatnot. Yeah. But I'd have still come back at that point. The point where I would have been running for the hills was 5-10 minutes into that interminable second act, I suppose.
Because I wasn't sure at first whether they were playing the same characters, you know, and then it was this thing about writing the script for the character and all that kind of thing, that suddenly were they improvising? Probably not. You know, it was kind of quite strange. It was that thing where it seemed to get stranger and stranger. And then you couldn't kind of relay it back to what you'd seen to start with.
I think it's like an exercise that I imagine they get you to do in actor training college.
Yeah.
We're all going to line up and we're all going to say things, and you don't know at what point we're going to jump in, and somebody's going to say shocking things, and... blimey, Charlie, I tell you. What a way to end the year.
Yeah.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on iTunes, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.